This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
1984, and I think it's been updated since. But it's really a book worth reading. I hope it's still in print. This is a paperback book that I have. And check it out. Check it out. See if Powell's has it. See if the library has it. It's really a book worth reading. Anyway, while we're waiting to get our guest, let's talk about Pope John Paul I. A lot of people don't remember him. Everybody remembers John Paul II, Karol Wojtyla, the Polish pope. You know, he's pope for a long time, traveled around a lot, very charismatic guy. But he was preceded by Pope John Paul I, who's an Italian named Albino Luciani. And he was pope in 1978, and he was only pope for 33 days, and then he died in September 1978. As far as people know, he was in good health. He was not an old guy. I think he was in his 60s. And he was known as a smiling pope. He was very humble guy. He really believed in the church of the poor. And he was really inspired by Pope John Paul XXIII, who was the one who convened the Second Vatican Council and had a lot to do with liberation theology in Latin America. And John Paul I was inspired by John the 23rd, and also by Paul the 6th, who came immediately before him. Paul the 6th is sort of a strange guy. He's sort of a Hamlet-type person, had a lot of self-doubts and kind of meant well, but didn't always do well. Anyway, when Albino Luciani became pope, he gets to choose what his official name will be, and he said John Paul I. So, in other words, he was sort of taking that as his inspiration, John the 23rd and Paul the 6th. Anyway, I'll tell you a little about him. He was, like I said, he was a very humble guy, known as a smiling pope. He had a lot of friends. He was not a real ambitious type. He really didn't want to be the pope. He wanted to be a priest. He was born in northern Italy, and he became the bishop of in Veneto, the region around the city of Venice, and he. He really didn't like all the pomp and stuff like that. He liked to walk around and meet the people. He liked to, as a bishop, whatever. He just liked to visit the churches, visit the people. He would like to walk around in the streets and talk to people. He was, and when he was the bishop in Venice, they had in churches around the world, there are banks where the priests and nuns put their savings, and the priest bank in Venice was the Banca Cattolica del Veneto, and this is where the priests, including Bishop Albino Luciani, sort of had their savings. And it was sold kind of out from under them to we have our author on the phone. Great. David Yallop, are you there? Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Well, we got you. Well, welcome to KBOO. I gave a little rundown of what your book is about. I talked a little bit about Albino Luciani, the smiling pope.
Yeah.
But now let's talk some more about him.
It'd be my pleasure.
Who was Pope John Paul I? What kind of a guy was he?
He came from a very poor family in the north of Italy. He decided at very young, as a little boy, around about the age of 8 or 9, that he wanted to be a priest. And at 11, he went off to seminary. Now, that was no easy thing for this family to do. The father was having to wander all over Italy to try and earn some money. I mean, this was a very rough time for the working class people in Europe, as it was in many other places, of course. And they had a kind of family discussion and a debate about whether they could afford this or not, and they decided they could. So he went off. He's a quiet lad, Albino Luciani, who became John Paul I. But there was something about him, and I was in the notes I was making, that even though he was quiet, he seemed to have a way about him where people were affected by this young man as he grew up there like that. He had a charm. He had a very good intelligence. And he was able to, bring people to his way of thinking without trying. I've got my word, we could do with somebody like that today in the world, couldn't we?
I think so, right. I did talk about how he became the bishop in Venice.
Oh, yeah.
And how the Banca Cattolica del Veneto was sort of sold out from under him. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I mean, the bank was owned on behalf of the people within Venice the Vatican looked after the business side of it there, but a large amount of the shares of the bank were still held by the priests inside Venice. And suddenly it was sold, as you rightly say, without any reference to them. I mean, there was a large debt standing on it, but the priests told me when I was up there researching the book that that would not have been a problem to pay because they would have found the money for it. But it was Marcinkus, who was the chairman of the Vatican Bank, who was the eminence green behind the selling of this bank, which was done without reference to Luciani, who was by this time the Patriarch of Venice. He was therefore the most important priest in town. No mention was ever made to him about it. And the first he knew was when he had a lot of very upset, irate priests at his door saying, you've got to do something about this. Now, this was not a man who, in his career up to that date, had been particularly preoccupied with the money side of the faith. He became very preoccupied after this because he wanted to find out why this had happened and how it had happened. And that actually began a journey for him, because 6 years later, of course, when Paul died, Paul the VI, he was elected. He didn't want to be Pope. In fact, one of the notes I made mentioned to you, an idea of this man's modesty and humility was, when the votes were starting to be counted and it began to look like, as to his astonishment, that it was a possibility of him becoming Pope, he got on his knees and prayed for God to find somebody else for the job.
Uh-huh.
Which I can think of an awful lot of people in that conclave who were praying exactly the opposite to that.
That's
wanting
true.
It for themselves. But
uh-huh.
And he had said to his secretary before he went in, he said, look, I'm not in any danger of being selected. He said, I'm not even a papilla, a possible for the job. And if by some mischance they should start talking about me when they come to me, I should say, no, thank you very much, I don't want the job. But I think he got so swept up with what was going on with the voting and all of that that he just said yes. And within an hour, he was actually regretting it, but he was too late then.
He became Pope, and you mentioned Paul Marcinkus, who was the head of the Vatican Bank. Now, he was an American priest who'd been kind of working in Rome for a long, long time.
He was indeed.
And when John Paul I became Pope, there were sort of three things. He was only in office for 33 days, but already he was investigating the Vatican Bank, and then he was going after the Masonic Lodge, P2, and then
you're very well researched, sir.
Well, I read your book twice. It's a fascinating book.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Tell us about the Vatican Bank and the Masonic Lodge
Vatican Bank is a book on its own, really, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, modern wealth of the Vatican began during the 1925-26 in Italy, when Mussolini was the dictator running and controlling Italy, and he cut a deal with the then Pope Pius the XI to resolve matters between the state and the church. And part of that deal represented a fair stack of money in the shape of, well, what, putting it at that figure at that time was about $81 million, which by the time we get to today would have been between three-quarters of a billion to $1 billion in value, in worth. And the then Pope, the 11th, wanted to invest some of this money because they'd been constantly in debt inside the Vatican for, well, ever since they lost the Papal States in the 19th century. And they brought in a man, Bernardino Nogara, a Catholic, who was a very bright man with money and a very bright man with figures. And they said, well, will you look after this? And he said, well, yes. He said, but I want to make two conditions to the Pope. And one is that I don't want any restrictions put on me because of religiosity in terms of what I can and can't invest in. And I want to be able to invest in any country in the world. And the Pope swallowed hard and said, all right, fine, you've got a deal. And now, of course, that opens the Pandora's box of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able, a very astute man, he was able to take that money and parlay it up. He went into all the markets. He went into the stock exchange. He went into things which would make your hair stand on end if you were a devout Catholic of that period, because the whole business of birth control had not, of course, been realized at this time in 1928. That came in the 60s. But he bought the bank, he bought the company that made most of the condoms in Italy. So the Vatican then began to profit.
That's right.
From an object which the church banned.
Mm-hmm. Then at one point, but then later on, didn't the bank, some of these business properties that they owned was a little embarrassing, so they kind of decided to get into a higher form of finance.
Well, they got into every kind of finance conceivable. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was dubious because inevitably the mafia were involved in a lot of the property. They became eventually the highest property owners of rental property, for example. Mm-hmm. Huge portfolios. And I quote figures there. So that by the time in the early 50s, when this man I've mentioned there, Nogara, was coming towards the end of his time there, the $80 million, $81 million, he wasn't given all of it. The Pope held back $30 million. He was given $50 million to play with in 1926. Well, he did very well with that. I'm just looking at some of the figures I've written down here for you, which include, on one investment there, $750 million, and another one, $1.4 billion. And topping all these figures up there, we're talking in the order of something like about $4 or $5 billion had been created out of an initial investment of $50 million. Now, my word, I could think there's a few banks in New York that could do with something like that today, wouldn't there?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. This is Fight the Empire, and we're talking with author David Yalop, who wrote this book, In God's Name. And Marcinkus, he was the head of the Vatican Bank. Let's talk a little bit about the Masonic Lodge, P2.
And P2 was created by a man called Licio Gelli. Licio Gelli had an interesting career himself. Most of these people, they're like characters out of a fictional book, actually. During the Second World War, he used to carry two passports, one which was a fascist passport and the other which was a pro-establishment passport. And it depended who he stopped him as to which passport got shown. So this was how he managed to survive during the Second World War. He worked for the fascists, and simultaneously was working for the communists. It's very versatile. But as it came towards the end of the war, and they put him on trial, and he managed to get away from that, because I think both sides could have shot him in terms of the crimes that he committed, he began to actually consider the future. And he thought, a creation of power, not so much criminality, but absolute power, contacting the people who ran the country, becoming one of them, and becoming eventually more powerful than the established government. What he first of all did was he made friends with retired admirals, retired generals, so all the military of Italy. And through them, he then made friendships with the acting and the then generals and the then admirals, and he inducted them all into what was really an illegal lodge. And from around about 1960-61, I would say he ran Italy. He had more power than any government that they had at that point, and that continued into the 90s. Berlusconi, for example, who is now trying to get back into power in Italy as we talk now, he's a member of P2. It still exists. Mm-hmm.
So we might tell our listeners that according to church law, becoming a Mason is sort of like automatic excommunication.
Well, indeed so. I mean, one of the things that Albino Luciani was going to clean up on was the money. That we discussed a bit of that. But there was also the masonry, because this was one of the most serious sins that a Roman Catholic could commit, and it had been since the 16th century.
And this, there were a lot of people in the Vatican itself were members of P2.
Yes, they were. They had their own lodge.
Uh-huh. And this P2 was like a state within a state.
Yes, it was. It was like a state within a state inside being in Italy there. I mean, if you wanted to, it was said to me many times when I was researching this book, which was, it began around about 1980, 81, somewhere around there. But it would be said to me with people that I would be discussing this with who were members of P2, and they would talk to me on the basis of confidentiality of not disclosing name, which I quite accept. But they would say, look, in Italy from 1960 on, if you wanted to get on in the world of business, of finance, insurance, or anything at all, you had to be a member of P2. It was a very exclusive club, and he wielded enormous power right across, unimaginable. So there's it's very difficult to believe that one man, and through him, other people could control the whole system. But he did.
And wasn't he involved with so-called terrorist groups? Like
yes,
there was this group that bombed the Bologna railroad station?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was.
And these were kind of false flag operations, I believe.
Yes, they were. And he was many a time put on trial and found guilty, sentenced to 10 years here, sentenced to 12 years there. But, you know, somehow it would go to appeal, and somehow the appeal would find for him, or it would reduce the sentence, and then he would walk out of the courtroom.
Oh my!
and never serve the sentence.
So then we have Albino Luciani is made the Pope. John Paul I, and he comes to the Vatican, and he's got. Right away, he begins investigating the Vatican Bank.
Well, I don't want to be very rude there, but he had already started investigating way back in Venice.
Oh, okay.
Once the matter of the Venetian Bank that we talked about earlier in this conversation emerged, he quietly then began to question and talk to people that he trusted. He began to investigate. Who were these people? Who was this man, Roberto Calvi? Who was this man, Marcinkus? Because he'd had nothing at all to do with any of these people up until this point. So by the time you come 6 years on, he had a huge dossier on all of this. So people often said to me, well, he couldn't have got all this stuff together in 33 days. No, he couldn't. Mm-hmm. But he could in 6 years. And he knew who to speak to when he was in the Vatican. He knew who had more information that would be useful for this. And on the last day of his life, September the
28th, I think, was it?
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes. You're very well informed.
I got notes.
But he had a meeting with his cardinal in charge of affairs, Velo, and in the middle of the afternoon, he had a meeting, and he said, I want the following changes brought in, and I want them brought in tomorrow morning. And he listed some in the Vatican Bank. One of the first ones, the most important one, was removing Marcinkus. But there were others. There were three other men, I think, as well, that he was going to remove. And then he moved into other areas, and he was transferring people and moving them around. And basically, what he was trying to do was begin the cleanup of the Vatican. And he said, I want all these things be put into action for tomorrow morning to be started with, but the removal of Marcinkus cannot wait. He's doing far too much damage, far too much corruption is coming out from that source. We've got to remove him immediately, or tomorrow morning, rather. And, of course, he went to bed and never got out of that bed. So it was a very convenient time for the Pope to die from the point of view of the corrupt inside the bank.
Well, you mentioned several people who had a lot to fear from...
Well, indeed. Count Roberto Calvi, who was eventually found hanging underneath a bridge in London.
Mm-hmm.
Marcinkus himself. Sindona, who was Sicilian mafia.
He was a banker also.
And out of the six, it became clear to me that Jelly was the power structure of this. He wouldn't have been pulling triggers himself. He wasn't that kind of man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it wasn't done that way. It was done with poison. And in the most recent versions of the book, in the last two or three years, where I've updated, not the book, but the ending, where more evidence has come to light,
mm-hmm.
there's some very interesting, more detail there that goes to confirm what I've alleged all along there. I'm quite convinced, absolutely convinced, that this man was murdered.
Uh-huh.
And he was murdered not for because he was going to actually legalize birth control, which he was, which is so sad that he didn't live long enough to do that.
Mm-hmm.
He was murdered because he was going to remove Marcinkus. Now, if you remove Marcinkus way back there in September 1978, then the fact that there was a huge embezzlement going on, which the Vatican was a part of, the laundry that Calvi was using, and playing scams and moving shares around. And without Marcinkus acting as the keystone, as it were, to keep the whole thing in place there, if anyone came in that was appointed by Luciani was honest, then the thing would start to collapse, and suddenly there would be a hole. And indeed, of course, there was a hole. There was a hole, was it 1.3 billion that was found after Calvi's death?
Uh-huh. Roberto Calvi. Now, he owned the bank, Banco Ambrosiano.
Indeed so.
That was a bank that wound up buying the bank in Venice, right?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's...
you should be doing this interview.
No. Anyway, I'd like to... Let's talk about the circumstance of his death. He had the night of the 28th, he had dinner with a couple of priests, and then he went to bed. Now, he was taking medicine for low blood pressure, I believe.
Yes, very, but it's a very moderate medicine. Mm-hmm. It's actually one that my doctors have got me on now, mm-hmm. ironically. And it is a very mild dosage of things. That was the only thing he was taking. And also, he was receiving regular visits from his Venetian doctor. He never saw any medical people in the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
Because Dr. Da Ros, who was his doctor up in Venice, he came down. He had a deep relationship with the Pope and wasn't going to leave him at the mercies of the butchers inside the Vatican. And I think he had four visits. So in that period of a month, he came once a week to see him. And one of the secretaries recalled to me that he asked Dr. Da Ros, "How is the Pope?" And he said, "The Pope is not well. The Pope is very well."
Mm-hmm.
And that was, 24 hours before he was dead.
And he was only in his 60s, right?
Yes, he was. He was mid-60s.
So the suspicion is that somebody put poison in his medicine.
Mm.
And then you say that the next morning when they found him dead, Cardinal Velo... took his medicine bottle.
Mm. He did a lot of things. He took the papers out of his hand, which were the Pope's own copy of the changes that he was making.
Uh-huh.
As you say, he took the medicine bottle. He took a whole range of things away there. But then, because it had been that the Pope had been found by a nun,
mm-hmm.
and that was covered up. Now, there was nothing improper about it. She had been with Albina Luciani, John Paul I, for many, many years up in Venice and before Venice, when he was a mere priest, and he had brought her down because it meant he had somebody familiar down there that he could trust and know and could search. She was also a qualified doctor. That was very useful for him.
Mm-hmm. So, and they also had a very quick embalming of the Pope, too.
Well, they certainly did. I certainly did, and one of the things they came out with, they said, well, of course, we can't do a post-mortem, it's against the rules. Well, it isn't against the rules. I proved that and demonstrated it was another lie.
Mm-hmm.
I quoted to them an autopsy that had been done in the 19th century, in the middle of the 19th century, when you didn't quite have the same level of sophistication of medicine that you had in the time of Albina Luciani. And they just covered up. They covered up all over the place, and lied and lied and to this day, really, in essence, they are still lying. They're still covering up, although not the Apple at the perpetrators of that period, because they've all gone.
Right. Well, I guess Marcinkus died recently. He actually retired in Arizona or something. I read that.
Yes, he did.
Is Lee Chojeli? Is he gone also?
Jelly, I think, is the one that's still alive. I know you were going to ask me that.
And he'd be pretty old by now. But then John Paul II became Pope, and he sort of undid everything that John Paul I did.
Well, he undid everything that he was aspiring to do. I mean, he left Marcinkus in charge, and he knew, he was shown the evidence, and he knew the strength of it, and he left it there. Because as long as the bank was making money, he was content. Which is a very strange morality for a pope to have. You would expect a higher level of morality, I would think so anyway. You see, the trouble I have is that, I mean, I think I've confronted two what I consider great popes in my life. One is John the 23rd, and the other was John Paul the I. When I say confronted, I mean been aware of their presence. And I think those two men were quite remarkable. And all those around, including the current one who's about to retire, they come nowhere near that quality of man that those two men had.
Well, that was kind of like a high point in church history. So the Vatican Bank is still operating. Is the P2 Lodge, is that still around?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. All systems are go.
So the church, this man was removed. Now, who do you... Lee Chojeli, he was not at the scene, but you call him the puppet master. Do you have any idea who the puppet was who actually might have done the deed?
No, I mean, it could have been just an ordinary minion, really, because what was required was the transference of medicine from one thing to another. Very simple thing to do. And on that particular night, both of the secretaries were not there, contrary to what they subsequently said. I proved that. So and the nun would have retired. So the Pope was in bed, and there was no one there protecting him.
Right.
And they've gone in there at that moment, opportunely. I mean, it could have been another night, but it wasn't. It was that night. And indeed, it needed to be that night in terms of what the information that came out afterwards about the removal of Marcinkus the following morning, you see.
Right. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. I've been talking with David Yalop, author of In God's Name, and I highly recommend this book. It's got lots of detail in it that we just barely touched. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And this is Per Fagerheim, Fight the Empire, signing off. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
And good morning from KBOO Portland. Coming up at 10:15 on Flashpoints, a new speech by noted activist and legal scholar Lawrence Lessig on the corrupting influence of money on politics. And then at 11 on Between the Covers, host Dan Johnson speaks with Erica Bauermeister about her new book, The Lost Art of Mixing, a sequel to The School of Essential Ingredients. And at 11:30, in the sixth episode of 100 Tacks, Andrew Weymouth explores the story behind a 9-foot-tall animatronic bear from the turn of the last century and the fading industry that spawned its creation. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to KBOO.fm, and clicking on Donate Today. All right, coming up next, we've got headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre on Air Cascadia.
KBOO is excited to be a media sponsor for the 36th Portland International Film Festival, presented by the Northwest Film Center. This year, 93 features and 46 short films from more than 36 countries will screen until February 23rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm/PIFF2013.
morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, February 21st, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kbo.fm on the web. Well, the debate over domestic use of drones continues, and absent are the questions that we really want answered. What about the targeted assassinations which are permitted under the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act? Are we going to be looking forward to targeted assassinations on American soil? It's legal. And the Chuck Hagel nomination is under massive attack from conservative corners. How it's viewed overseas, however, is another very different concern. Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham, has come out with an actual number for the deaths caused by drone strikes overseas. And India has its own sort of land-based drone strike of a sort. 50 people at least, I expect that number is going to go a bit higher. 50 people killed in a suicide bombing in Hyderabad, a city which has never seen this sort of thing before. In fact, India hasn't until recent years seen